Mackenzie.
Lamar.
Black and White Month rolls on full steam ahead. We have
Black
another.
Black and White Month.
Yeah. BW Month, B-dubs we call it. I was curious because I wanted to knock out a couple of these questions since I don't know when the next time we're going to cover some of these classics might be, but.
Whenever you want. Just whenever you want.
You know, fuck it. FanJan is done. We're going more classics in January. So. What I want to know is, do you have a favorite of the, like, did we cover your favorite of the bunch this month, or is there another one you wish we had done? Which one is your top?
So of classics specifically, that's really hard. So as I am wont to do, I have like a top five for everything instead of a top one for everything. But I will say for classics especially, it feels really hard because it's like, it's very mood dependent for me. One of my favorites is His Girl Friday that we did.
Yeah.
So I love that. I just love the witty repartee. That's one of my favorites. Another one we're gonna do, which is All About Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And that's maybe my favorite. That might be my favorite. I'll save the why for that episode, but that might be my favorite. I, of course, love a lot of the other classics that everybody knows, like A Casablanca and The Citizen Kane and things like that. But I love film noir. So this one that we're doing today is up there. It's not my favorite film noir, but it's up there for that genre specifically. So yeah.
Well, I'm sorry in advance because this is the one we're doing today is probably my least favorite. I've already seen All About. I watched All About Eve last week, but even before we discuss that one, I can tell you of the four, this is my least favorite. I'll get into the reason why. I think for its time, it's good, but we'll get into the reasons why.
Do you have a favorite of, well, you haven't seen that many. But
I haven't seen that many like pre-1960 films, honestly. So I think I had to watch Citizen Kane three times in college for different film classes. Like, it just always seemed to be on the syllabus. And I liked it.
It's a little overdone. It's very well done, but it's a little overdone.
It's a good movie. So I think of the ones that, especially the ones we've seen this month, I still go back to It Happened One Night. I really had a good time with that one. It was I think one of the shorter ones of the bunch. It was straight and to the point, and the comedy held up pretty damn well. So I think of the four we've seen this month, that's probably my favorite.
That's probably your fave. Yeah. I mean, it does. It holds up and it's very funny. I do think like we going back to how we picked the movies this month, I think there are other ones that I could pick that you would really enjoy versus like other people liking. And I get why we did it. Like I won't make him feel bad again.
It turns out that when your friend spends 4 hours putting together a list, maybe you should look at it for more than 30, but I'm glad we're doing this because I'm glad that I am watching a noir film just to experience it. But this one tells me I don't want to see too many more of them. And I'll get into why after the
okay.
credits.
Well, I'll tell you at the end if you actually don't want to see more film noir. You know what I mean? Because it could be this one and it could be some of the other ones that I recommended to you that you might like better. Anyway, we'll get into it. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And we are continuing Classics Month, or as Lamar obviously likes to call it, Black and White Month, with the Maltese Falcon.
It's always a race thing with me.
Every episode you got to bring this shit up. No, they're not all black and white, I will say, but all the ones we're doing this month are. So we've really put Lamar through his paces.
You know what fucked up thought I had during this film, speaking of race? There's a point where, and I'm not saying this is funny, but it was really messed up, where they say, what does the criminal look like? And they give the height and like what his face and like his physical description, but they don't mention race. And I'm like, oh, that's because at this time it's like, well, he's in a Hollywood movie, so obviously he's white. We don't need to point that out. Just like he's a character in a Hollywood film. So we don't need to say what race he is because obviously he's white. That was pretty dark, but.
What an observation and an unfortunately accurate one, but wow. Well, with all that in mind, the name of our cocktail today is going to be extra appropriate. So what are we drinking?
We should call it the Black and White Velvet instead of just the Black Velvet. I know we said we weren't going to do clever names for these because they are cocktails that have been around for a really long time. But yeah, this is a Black Velvet. And I mean, it's just like a third Guinness. And then you top it off with champagne. What kind of champagne did you use?
I think it's equal parts, actually.
Okay.
But we used, I actually used Prosecco, which is maybe cheating a little. And I just did the La Marca Prosecco. As I have mentioned on the pod before, sponsor us. It's a good little Prosecco.
I didn't even catch the brand that I grabbed. I just grabbed a Brut. And the recipe I saw said like a third Guinness and the rest champagne. So that's the proportions I did. But I like things a little sweeter anyway. So
yeah, there you go. All right. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
So do you like it? It's kind of a weird one. You know what I mean? Like it's, well, not
I like
weird,
it because it's soft. Janelle loves Guinness. I'm not a huge Guinness person. I do like some stouts, but I like them again to have a little bit of sweetness. Go figure. But this softens it a bit. I was actually curious about, I wanted to make sure because we keep saying we're doing classic cocktails for classic films. So I looked up the history of this drink. It was invented in 1861. So we're in the clear. Mm.
Yeah. We are in the clear. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, if Bogey drank it, it's classic. So
we're
doing good.
Apparently the reason it was created, I forget who it was, a queen's husband died and they created this drink in his honor because they wanted to have champagne in it, but they don't, champagne is such a celebratory drink that it's like, well, we're not celebrating his death, so let's put some Guinness in there. Fuck it. And that's how it was invented.
the naming is even more morbid with that in mind. I love that. But I like that the champagne, like I like Guinness. I don't always want a Guinness. You know, it's a time of year drink for me. Actually, this is a perfect time of year. It's rainy, it's cold, all the things. But I do like to lighten it up a little bit, which is basically what this does to it, if you're curious. It kind of makes it a little bit more effervescent, a little bit more fun. I think it's delish.
Yeah, if you're going to drink stouts, winter and cold season is the time to do it.
It is. It is indeed. So we're going to dig into all the things about the Maltese Falcon. We're not going to go into a deep dive on the folks involved. I'm actually just going to go through some names, essentially, and do the basics so we can get to the good stuff.
Can I tell you my first disappointment with this film? It's called The Maltese Falcon. No Han Solo, zero Chewbaccas. Already I was pissed off. I kept waiting for them to show up. Never happened.
We overpromised with the Falcon for you. I think it is. Yeah, yeah. But you know, isn't it great to know the references in these other movies? Like, I just, all jokes aside, that's what I love about going back and watching classic films. You hear the first time somebody said something or made a joke or made a reference or something that gets referenced on and on and on in films, you know, for forever. So that's my favorite part, is like going back to the beginning and being like, oh, that's where that comes from. Or, you know, so
the stuff dreams are made of. That's a quote that I've heard a million times and didn't realize it was from this film. So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. There's always one or two of those, I feel like. So at least in the very popularized ones that everybody saw, it absolutely contributed to the pop culture of the time and the zeitgeist, and some of it carries on. And so I think that's really fun. So anyway, real quick, this is the Maltese Falcon, as we said, 1941, very well reviewed, 7.9 out of 10 on IMDb, which is pretty solid, and 99% for critics, which is super solid.
Who's the one asshole that was like...
Apparently it's you. So
did not have color. Zero stars, would not watch again. Actually, I think I'm gonna give my I'll give out really quick my worst rating I have ever given out on the pod. I'm giving 0 stars to HBO Max subtitles because they've ruined part of this. They're so bad.
They're bad, and sometimes they're early.
Yes. They give you like the second half of a line of dialogue, but they don't give you the first half. So you're like,
I'm waiting for the punchline to hit and you just ruined it. You know, there's a lot of that. That's why, you know, for example, I can't watch subtitles on stand-up routines.
Right.
Because spoils the joke. And that's like, that is what they do. Yeah. HBO Max, figure out your subtitle game.
Get your shit together. And actually, I shouldn't even call it HBO Max now. It's just Max, which was a terrible marketing decision, but sure.
It was, and also maximum fail, guys. Get your shit together. So yeah, I think that this is very well reviewed on the whole, with the exception of Lamar going in and ruining the critic score. No, I'm just kidding. 91% from audiences, though. So pretty, like, yeah, just above 90 across the board.
I should point out now, it's not that this movie is objectively bad. It's not my style of film. What I found myself comparing it to the most, and I'll get into the reasons for why, were James Bond films. It feels like, I mean, it's a mystery, right? So it's not an action film, but a lot of the tropes carry over into the James Bond movies that would be made 20 years after this. So if you like a tough guy who's not showing a lot of emotion, who's romancing every female in the film, you're going to love this movie. And it's the first wave of that. So I'm going to probably have to give out two ratings today as far as objectively where I think this lies, but also my personal preference. It's just not my kind of movie.
Humphrey Bogart is like the OG of all those things, for sure. Yes. So the checks out. Yeah. So the director is Mr. John Huston. If you haven't heard him before, he's pretty prolific, pretty legendary in Hollywood. But this is actually his first directorial outing. So kind of exciting for him. If you know Angelica Huston, for example, this is her dad.
I have a secondary fun fact to that, and I just put together that they were fucking related thanks to you, because I was like, oh, so apparently I saw that he's the only director to have directed a parent and child duo both to Oscars, not in the same movie, but he directed Walter in The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Have you seen that one? And then he directed Angelica in Prizzi's Honor with Jack Nicholson.
And yeah, so, I actually haven't seen Prizzi's Honor, but that's cool.
But yeah, so I didn't even put together they were all related. So it's kind of makes sense why he's the only one to have ever done that.
I think, you know, Hollywood is actually one big small town, you know, as they say. A lot of nepos. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody's either friends or related or cousins or brothers or something. So checks out, really. We also have the source material for this is actually a novel. And so that author is Mr. Dashiell Hammett. He did actually a couple of other things, The Thin Man, Watch on the Rhine, and both of those were adapted as well.
Do you know if this sticks to the novel? Have you ever read the novel?
I haven't.
I'd be curious if this follows beat for beat, like the mystery of the novel, because I felt like at times this would be better to read than to see on screen.
It probably doesn't. Just, I mean, in general, films don't do that, to be fair. But I agree with you. Just seeing the plot, like I feel like it was probably tweaked for film, is what I would say. Yeah. You know, and that was done by John Huston as well. So he did the screenplay. He also was a prolific screenwriter and did that far before he was directing, actually. So he did Treasure of Sierra Madre. He wrote the screenplay for example, but a few others like Jezebel, The Asphalt Jungle, things like that. He also wrote. And then many more before that as well. So he did that long before directing. And like I said, this is his first one. And then we've got, you know, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Humphrey Bogart, Bogey, playing Samuel Spade. Is this your first Bogey? I have questions.
Yeah, I've never seen Casablanca, so I believe this is my first one.
Oh my God. There are so many problems with that statement. Like, I've never seen Casablanca. This is my first Bogey. Wow. Okay. Well, you have to see a Casablanca, obviously, which we've talked about before, but To Have and To Have Not's another big one. He's in The Big Sleep, which is great. So anyway, you got to watch all the Bogies. He's incredible. We love him.
Also a member of the Rat Pack. I didn't know that either. Like, Humphrey Bogart was a name I had heard a million times, but in my head, I couldn't picture what his face looks like. But I was not aware he was in the Rat Pack with Sinatra, and his wife actually coined the term Rat Pack. So then Frank tried to retire it after Humphrey Bogart died, and they just kept the media kept using it, and Frank kind of didn't love that term, actually, because it was like
he's not with us anymore. Yeah, totally. Well, next up we have Mary Astor. Not going to go through a ton of these. Maybe ones that y'all have known, though, would be like Meet Me in St. Louis, for example, she was in. And then also The Great Lie is another big one that she is known for. I actually haven't seen that, but she was in it as well. And then Gladys George. So she's been in some older things before this. Like, she did.
I thought you were just going to say she's been in some older things. Yeah. Okay.
Older things prior to this, I'm saying prior to.
She wasn't a member of the Ocean's 8 cast. Got it.
No, she didn't make a reappearance there, although she could have done great, I am sure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she was in the Roaring 20s, for example, before this. But again, not a lot of these that most people probably know, to be honest. So not going to dig deep into them. We also have Mr. Peter Lorre as Joel Cairo. And my favorite thing about him is that he's one of those that looks... He looks to me like he's been in so many more things than I can remember. As I was watching it, I was like, I've seen you in something else. I've seen you in more than, and I just pored over his IMDb trying to remember them all. He is in Casablanca with Bogey as well. But I was like, no, that's not what I'm picturing. I feel like I've seen him. I think he's one of those who's just this ancillary character who's been in a million of these little like studio features. Cause I couldn't even picture where I've seen him, but I feel like I've seen him a million times.
So I've heard the name before. Is it Peter Lorre or Peter Lorre? Or are those two different
people? Peter Lorre.
Okay. Because I'm like, maybe there's a different, I've heard this name before. And I was same thing. I was like, have I seen him in anything? And I had the exact thought, like going back to my earlier point, watching this, of he'd make a good Bond villain. Like he feels like this is a Bond movie. Like he feels like he would be that very, and it turns out he would go on to play the very first Bond villain. Granted, it wasn't a movie. It was a television series called Climax, but he played the Casino Royale part that Mads Mikkelsen played a few years ago. So I thought that was kind of cool that like, yes, he literally could be a Bond villain because he ended up being a Bond villain.
Because he is one. And he's he's one of those two. And I had this in my notes for later, but he's one of those two where like he is a foreign actor and you insert him into any foreign part, whether it's appropriate or not. Right. So like he's one of the few that has it penetrated Hollywood and they just stick him in any slightly foreign, slightly villainish role.
He would have been a great rustling bad guy just like to go against Hulk Hogan. Like this guy's 100%. From somewhere else that's not here.
Right. It's like stock footage for bad guys. Anyways. So, Lee Patrick, which I don't know if you say her name, last name, Patrick or Patrice, but she's the right-hand man, as far as I'm concerned, in this film. She's Effie, and she's been in a bunch of great stuff, including Vertigo, which is one of my faves.
That's
if you
Hitchcock,
haven't seen it.
Right?
Yeah. And I think that that is one that you would super like.
Okay.
Actually, that's a good one. Well, I think so.
She's also her guy's like wingman, it seems like, at the beginning when she's like, you're going to want to see her. She's hot.
I know. She's like,
you should definitely male gaze at her.
Listen, I've had guy friends where I'm like, I know you're going to be into that. Like, have a good time. You know what I mean? It's not all bad. It's just, you know their style. You know their style, what they're into. But yeah, she's definitely a great wingman for sure. So these are the majors. I'm going to give you a quick plot summary and then we want to get into some good stuff, which is San Francisco private detective Sam Spade takes on a case that involves him with three eccentric criminals, a gorgeous liar, and their quest for a priceless statuette, with the stakes rising after his partner is murdered. Dun dun dun
dun dun dun.
I know. Yes.
The film did have a good score even from the get-go. That initial burm, burm, as it's giving you the opening. I didn't think we needed the whole explanation at the beginning of what the bird is or where it came from, because it all gets exposited later anyway. But I did like the score coming in real hard from the get-go.
The score is legit. I think on the whole, the way this is shot is really well done. Like the production design is really well done. I know we joked in It Happened One Night about the screen during the car being like just dating the movie.
Yeah.
But there are several moments in this where I'm really impressed by the way that they staged the depth. Like this is it's kind of like you said last time of, you know, a lot of these things feel like plays and being translated to the screen. And there are some tactics that have carried across from both, you can tell, to like show and define depth and things like that. And his office is supposed to be in San Francisco, where you can see skyline and the bridge. And there's a part where he goes to the scene of the crime and he's, you know, he's seeing over this hill and into the city and things like that. And all of that to me held up pretty well, pretty darn well for the time. So I think on the whole, the production is still holds up pretty well.
It looks beautiful. I was curious. I meant to Google this. I'd be curious what number appearance this was for the Golden Gate Bridge, because I feel like that's the most pictured landmark in cinema. Like, you always, if a film is set in San Francisco, there's gonna be if you're watching The Room by Tommy Wiseau, there's like 8 shots of the Golden Gate Bridge. It doesn't make sense, but I wondered if this was one of the first ones to do that or in the first 20. I'd be curious about that.
I think it was pretty early on, especially because they fucking announce it. Like, literally, it's like you're in San Francisco and then there's a badging of the Golden Gate Bridge. Yeah. Like, we want you to know what this is, which is, you know, when you're announcing the location, you don't often announce the landmark. You don't go New York City, the Empire State Building. You know what I mean?
Statue
like,
of Liberty.
Right. So I think it was like a big moment for sure. So yeah, I think that's a great call. And it probably was one of the first for sure.
Maybe it was like the introduction. Maybe that's why they put the name on there. They were like, hey, 1941, get used to this guy. You're going to be seeing him a lot. But it was like, no one knew what the Golden Gate Bridge was if you didn't live in San Francisco. That's the history I'm sticking to.
Okay. Well, we're sold. I mean, I'm not going to argue with you. They're going to have to fact check us to be sure. So, well, I mean, you get right into it too, is the other thing about this movie. Like, you're in San Francisco, you're told exactly where you are, but then you immediately go into, like, there is some drama at the top. Again, we got Wingman Effie being like, hey, there's a sexy lady in your office who wants to talk to you. And then you go in there and this girl is at 1,000. Immediately, you know, she's just already, you can tell, gonna be a ball of fun.
And also, and for the record, guys, again, the movie's almost 100 years old. We're spoiler warning, whatever.
But, oh yeah, turn around, don't drown.
Yeah,
it's spoiler time, because yeah, this movie's almost 100 years old. Yeah, so she just comes in with a case. You know, she needs help. She is asking him immediately to kind of save the day. And my favorite thing about this is that he just looks suspicious the whole time, 100% of the time. And you can't tell, at least at first, whether it's about her or about, this is just how he is with everybody, right? Like, is this just how he operates? He just assumes that everyone is lying, because he's definitely approaching her with real skepticism about her story, right? And I want to ask you your first take, having not seen this before, because it's hard for me to watch it like I've never seen it before. What was your take on this first scene with them and her whole story, her whole spiel? Like,
I think one of the things that I wrote down was that with the rest of the movies this month, the tropes that appear, I think, have been repeated throughout the last 100 years. And sometimes it does better. This is the one of the ones where I feel like all the tropes in this have been improved upon. And it's hard to watch this in 2024 and be like impressed, I guess. I feel like if you were to watch a show like Sherlock, where he kind of narrates through and they zoom in on like the sweat beads and like the little ticks and they point out how they know people are lying, I think it would read a little bit better. Whereas in this, I bought her story off the bat, because it wasn't until later that he's just like, you were lying the whole time. And then he points out the inconsistency. I wish that they had sort of addressed that. I feel like Sam Spade isn't all that great of a detective, honestly. Like, a lot of the cases,
you know, who
falls
is
into his lap.
Effie's pretty great, actually. Effie's super observant, because that's the difference. You know, women are just very naturally observant. So she could just be a detective out of the gate.
I agree, if not for her, because a lot of this falls into his lap. The scene where right after this, when he goes to Archer's death scene and he's standing at the top of the hill and there's a broken fence and his body's at the bottom and he's like, so he got shot up here and then he broke the fence and rolled down the hill. Do I have that right? I'm like, yeah, but well, fucking of course. Like, he's not that good of it.
But I mean, obviously.
But yeah, like, I think that initial scene is cool. It gets it established. I like that they do have the tension between the two partners, because I was a little, again, first watch, I was a little confused why he didn't seem super upset when he found out his partner died. And then you find out he was kind of might have been having an affair with the wife, or like his partner and the wife were on the outs and getting divorced, all this stuff. But yeah, like, a little slow out of the gate for me personally.
I feel like it's funny you say that like, why doesn't he care about his partner and like his partner dying? And is it because he's having this affair after all? I think that's just supposed to be Sam. You know what I mean? Like, I love when he calls Heffy to tell her that Archer died and was shot. And he's like, Archer was shot. Yeah, dead. You know, and she, like, and
repeating
she's
back what they're saying on the phone.
That's right. Dope. And he's like, and she's like having, you know, she's getting upset. And he's like, don't get excited now. You know, like it's all almost monotone. He's just like, why are you getting so excited? He just died. Like, what's a big deal? You know? And I just love that kind of almost monotone to his emotionless about things that you expect him to be emotional about. And I think that's interesting juxtaposed against later scenes where he's flying off the handle, right?
The anger.
The tip of a hat, yeah.
The falling in love over the court. I fucking hate this. Again, if you love James Bond movies and you love action things with the main character being this stoic person that doesn't seem to feel much, but at the end of the movie's like, I love you. And it, well, where did fuck that come from? Like, I don't love the tropes. I don't love the genre that this sort of gave rise to. So that entire him being just certified badass at the beginning and then at the end confessing his love and I actually liked it when he got angry in the last like 2/3 of the film because it was nice to have him not be cool, calm, and collected for a change.
Yeah, I do like that he, I don't like the 0 to 60 of it all personally. Yeah. Just like, I shouldn't say as a performance. I should just say, like, if you're watching this character as a person, you're just like, hey, why is this person totally emotionless in this context? And then in this other context, he's going to 100. But he does a really good job of performing it. And I think the other thing to understand about him, too, is that on the whole, he is pioneering this kind of character. Yeah. Like, I know you're likening it to James Bond, but he's pioneering specifically the character of like a hard-boiled detective, which is the beating heart of film noir, right? And so this feels like something we've seen over and over again, but he's kind of the template. You know, his performance here is the template for that going forward. And while I agree, I don't know if it's the best iteration of that, because I think other ones later do it better, like I said. I think it's the first time we've seen someone perform this kind of character in this way. And what's interesting about him and makes him kind of engaging is that he's really morally ambiguous. Like, you don't know if you're supposed to like him. You also don't really know if you're supposed to like anybody. That's the whole, I think that's part of the premise here is like, who are we supposed to rely on? Who are we supposed to trust? Certainly no one feels immediately trustworthy other than Effie, right? Like, Effie's the only one that we like immediately like and trust, at least for me. She's the real fucking hero of this movie as far as I'm concerned. And when we learn that, you know, she's already lying to him, that O'Shaughnessy has like misrepresented her name 3 times in the 10 minutes we've seen her total, right? So she's very untrustworthy. But I think what's interesting is that his cynicism is a character in and of itself. His emotionlessness is a character in and of itself. And I think what they're trying to do when they show him kind of break out of that is show that he's also a little, he's human, but those are the parts that he doesn't want to expose. Like, those are the parts that he doesn't want to admit. That's something cracking in him. And at least that's the way that I read it and see this type of character. And people do it, like I said, based on this template later as well, and sometimes better. But I think that's supposed to be something you're not supposed to see about him, right? Those outbursts, those emotions, him falling in love, right? Those are supposed to be the secret intimate moments that we're privy to, you know?
Yeah, I am in full agreement with you that for the time when this came out, it's kind of revolutionary. It's giving you a character who is kind of morally ambiguous. And I think not just the spy genre or the detective genre, but you can probably say that this kind of character gave rise to the Westerns and like these badass cowboy characters who have questionable morals, but at the end of the day end up doing the right thing, right? So I do completely agree. This is super influential. So I don't want to like poo-poo it too much, but I had a hard time, buying in at the beginning because it's like, okay, well, he's kind of, I was surprised he took the woman's money at the beginning when he's like, yeah, and then he like looks down like she didn't give him enough. She puts another bill on the table and he's like, yeah, that'll do fine. And then he might be potentially accepting bribes later in the movie. You assume he's probably got a plan, but I don't think we're kept in the loop enough. So we kind of are guessing not just about who killed who and where is the Falcon, but also like, is this a good guy? Which first watch, I think on rewatch I'd appreciate it more, but first watch was a little rough.
I mean, now that you know the ins and outs, it's definitely an easier watch. I think that they do get better at that later from a storytelling perspective in film noir in general. They get better at backing into the story from something that you know as a baseline, right? So that you, because this is a little bit more all over the place. You are a little bit more like, who am I supposed to, again, who am I supposed to agree with, support, whatever, it, trust, etc. What is the baseline reality here? Is Sam in it for himself truly in the way that he's negotiating with these bad guys? Or is he trying to trap them and catch this person and just presenting this one way? So yeah, I do feel like that's not clear. I feel like in some ways that could make it more interesting. And in some ways it does make it more confusing of a watch. And I think later in other film noirs, like I said, they're better at kind of giving you a framework of like generally where it's going to go. It's still going to be mysterious, but you're going to know something about it that helps you kind of follow that tether throughout.
Yeah. I the moral stuff just... I don't, if you're gonna, again, the I love you at the end is cheap. That entire final speech, I'm not jumping all the way to the end, but that last thing where he says, I'll wait for you, if you, maybe you'll get 20 years and I'll wait the whole time, that falls so flat for me, because at the beginning of this, it's basically stated like he was fucking his partner's wife and he kind of has feelings for his secretary too, is the vibe I got of like, there's something there, chemistry maybe, but I don't buy him falling for this woman who's been lying to him the whole time. And that just feels cheap. And I know it's just a product of the genre again, that we sort of have to buy into that, but it just fell flat with the whole wife thing too. She's sort of a red herring of like, maybe she killed somebody or didn't, but I didn't need that.
See, I don't read it that particular thing that way. So I don't think he has feelings for Effie at all. I think he sees Effie as like, again, his wingman. You know what I mean? Like she's an angel and she's a whatever, but she also is like the only person the only woman, especially in this context, that he trusts, that he doesn't judge in the same way. Like you hear him talking shit about all these other women, right? Like he has something negative to say about all these other women. So I definitely think of Effie as like a bro to him, but I agree. I think it's definitely implied that he a hoe, you know, like he for sure is a hoe and he makes the rounds, right? But I think that's the thing about his partner's wife as well. I don't think there's any emotionality there to that. I think she's a hoe and he a hoe and they hoed together for a hot minute. You know what I mean? And so I think the implication is that she is not loyal to him, but he's not loyal to her. Like, you know, even when he hears her talking about, or, you know, she has to inform her about the death of his partner. She's like, keep her away from me. You know, he has no interest in talking to her at all. Certainly not engaging with her. She comes to the office and she's like, oh, won't you help me? Da, da, da. You know, and she's like, come see me. And she's like, won't you? And he's like, when I can, which is basically like, absolutely not. I will absolutely not be doing that. And I think he just sees her as another person that he essentially made the rounds with. He seems very unemotional about those types of connections prior to this. I think what you're supposed to get from it, I should say, which doesn't, I will agree with you, doesn't land perfect because of the way that he's playing this character as being so emotionless. But I think O'Shaughnessy is supposed to be this exception, you know, this big exception to him having actual feelings for a person versus these other conquests, these other kind of transactions. And I think it's supposed to be because she, yes, she's a liar and she's lied a lot, but she eventually slowly like comes clean to him throughout and says some very self-disparaging things, right? She said, she acknowledges that she's constantly been a liar since forever. She can't remember when she used to tell the truth, that she's not a good person, that she's done terrible things. Like, and this on screen especially is not something you would see. You know, this just didn't, you didn't have women, one, very often being the bad guy, but two, openly disparaging themselves and in characteristics that have been largely reserved for male figures, right? Largely reserved for masculine powers in these films, right? This is the first woman we see in a long time who's like, listen, I'm an opportunist. I'm a liar. I've done some shit. And she says it all outright. And I think that's what makes her an exception to him. Because even though the partner's wife is kind of a hoe, she's putting on a performance everywhere she goes to him and to everyone else, right? She's pretending that she cares about him. She doesn't. She's pretending that she cared about her husband dying. She doesn't. But she's not going to say that, you know? O'Shaughnessy is saying it. And I think that's what he can relate to. and what he respects about her. And I think we're supposed to see her as an exception because of those things.
I suppose that's fair. It just doesn't feel super, or I would have rather they just had her be a complex villain character without having any of the emotion, the feelings get involved. Because even the first kiss, just, I'm like, what? He's like, all you've given me is money. You need to earn my confidence some other way. Kiss me. What?
No, and I love, my favorite part about that scene, one, you're right, but two, my favorite part about that scene is she's like, well, how else am I going to earn it? And he kisses her, and we're like, oh, sex. That's how, that's how we got to earn it.
That's how a man knows you're telling the truth.
Yes, because that's when we're most truthful, right? Obviously. Yeah. So, no, I love that. It was so funny. But I agree with you that the first kiss, especially, it does kind of, it's a 0 to 60 moment yet again. I do think they're sort of trying to lay that groundwork. Don't get me wrong. But I think the timing could be better for sure. And I think my big observation here is that Lamar just doesn't like when there's a love story. He's like, fuck you very much. I don't need your out of nowhere love stories. I just want the drama. I don't want any love. Fuck this.
It's a product of cinema. You know, I mean, I know that I don't know, this is a complex thing. We're like, cinema, we are in a rut, not a rut, but like there are a lot of sequels and requels and remakes and all these things where we do run it back. Sure. But I think at this point, if you're going to tell an original story, like I think we are more in the habit of the writers and the directors having to earn love stories. I'm trying to think of a good example of a recent film where like there is a male and a female lead who don't end up together at the end because it doesn't fucking make sense for them to end. Like it's not just, oh, there's chemistry here because it's a man and a woman. Like it has to be earned, and I don't think they do enough early in this to get that last thing to hit for me. But I wanted to pivot to like, what do you think the overall mystery of this, and this is what I was talking about earlier with like the book, and I'm curious to know, does the book, is it the exact like beat for beat in the way it unravels the mystery? What do you think looking back on this, knowing it is from 1941, like how do you think it plays out? And do you like the actual mystery story being told?
I think the mystery story is a bit complex. Mm-hmm. I think they introduce a lot of characters that make it maybe almost unnecessarily confusing. Yeah. I do think it becomes a template for mysteries in the future, and even Bond films, for example, which again, based on novels, so I don't want to say too much about that, but just, I think it becomes a template to the effect of, if we introduce a lot of characters with a lot of unknown motivations, then we automatically have a mystery on our hands, right? Yeah. And I think that's kind of, it's done okay here. It's not done perfect here. You see it done poorly later, actually, for that reason, where it's really overly complex, like I said. I think what would be more interesting is sticking to the complexity of the characters themselves. I will say that, like, if we reduced even just one or two people in this film and we spent a little bit more time with certain characters, that could be a more interesting mystery to me. Like, let's spend more time with Joel and understand his motivations, you know. Let's spend more time with the fat man and understand like how he got there. He does get the most
Did we need to have Gutman and for him to have two henchmen? Like, why do we need both of those guys?
Right, exactly. Why do we need two henchmen? Let's eliminate a henchman. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. I do feel like we get more time with Gutman, and that is some of the more intriguing scene work, right? Like, they're having interesting stories. You're getting the backstory. You're understanding this person's motivation. And now you're getting into a real negotiation that calls into question both of their motives in a more interesting and engaging way, in an engaging scene. Those are the parts that I love. Those are the parts that I think are really more interesting. I think you could trim the fat a little because this story is a bit overly complex, and we could keep it about the people and their motivations, and it could still be pretty mysterious.
Yeah, the more intriguing mystery, and I know they weave the two mysteries together. Like, I don't really give a shit about the bird. Like, the whole, we're trying to get this bird, I'm going to pay you to get the bird, and I know where the bird is, but you can't. I don't like that, the power dynamic. And again, it feels like a Bond movie without action sequences, or when they get in the room with the villain, and the villain unravels everything and tells them how we got here. And it's just that does it. That's why I'm like, if I read this in a book format, would it land a little bit more for me? But the more intriguing mystery is the deaths, like who killed his partner, who killed this other guy. And they're trying to weave it together. And it does, you know, weave together with the bird in the end. But the big reveal that O'Shaughnessy is the one who killed his partner, I think that's the thing that lands the most for me of like, oh shit, yeah. I actually didn't see that twist coming. But the whole Falcon drama doesn't really do much for me.
I think it's supposed to be the through line. It's like, why are all these people involved with each other? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like, why are they all engaged? And why are they so motivated? Right. Like, what else would motivate them but this really expensive, you know, heirloom kind of thing? Because, you know, even just the money wouldn't be as intriguing. I think you get to tell this story that spans centuries, you know, versus being able to just be like, we got some money that we are trying to track down, you know, like that's not as engaging. I think it's supposed to add some mystique to the story. But I still agree that it could be simplified, you know, and the people's involvement with it could be simplified. What I do think it gives us that's really interesting, though, are some really unique characters that, for example, you would not see in cinema. Certainly in like the 90s, 2000s eras of film, maybe more so now we could see this kind of person, but we definitely wouldn't have in this kind of mid period of hyper masculine men on screen, right? Like that. And I say that because I think it's really interesting how Bogey is supposed to be that. He's supposed to be hyper masculine and strong, but he has these very sensitive characteristics about him that appear, like simple things like giving a nose kiss, for example. Like, what the fuck was that, Bogey? There's, you know, just things like that that are like these intimate parts of him that make him a little bit more emotional than your average just blustering man, right? This blustering, angry dude. And then you also have characters like one of these henchmen who's tearing up at the recurring bullying that's happening to him.
For all I've said about we don't need two henchmen, I do like how sensitive he is to everything.
He is such a fucking baby.
Like, I'll shoot you. I'll do it. Stop bullying
me. And he's just talking shit. And I love that when he stands up, the very first time he encounters him in the hotel lobby, for example, and he's like talking a lot of shit, you know, they're about to throw down, right? And then he basically just gets the manager to kick him out and whatever.
This guy's got a gun. He should go.
He should go.
It was a different time.
Fuck. I know, right?
A better time, you could argue.
Exactly. And so he just leaves, but he's like talking shit on the way out. But my favorite part is like he stands up and he's like kind of a short guy. You know, he's like kind of short next to Bogey, which is not inherently a problem, but I mean, like, in the comparison of the two, he's trying to be this tough guy next to this taller guy who just got kicked him out by saying a couple words, you know, and he's very emotional about it. You know, he's very upset that he's being kicked out. He's very upset that he continues to get bullied. He's like, I've had all I'm going to take from you, you know, and he's cracking under the pressure of the bullying and he's tearing up. And my thing, though, is that nobody blinks. Like, yeah, they're annoyed with him and they're like, calm down, you're fine, whatever. But Gutman doesn't make a big stink out of it. He's not like, pull yourself together, man, you know? And Humphrey is not making fun of him for being emotional. It's just interesting to me that that is actually kind of accepted on film in this context, even though it's now with the lens of modern lens that we have now, we would just be looking at that and be like, really, bro? We're crying about this. And they don't even give him shit for that.
Sam Spade is affectionate for sure, which is something that James Bond is. James Bond sleeps with women and is like, you know, very passionate, but I would never describe any of the Bonds as affectionate. Meanwhile, in this, yeah, he is, you know, that the terms we sort of romanticize it now, depending on your viewpoint, you might also think it's kind of offensive, but referring to the women as angel and doll, like in that time period, it was terms of affection, right? It wasn't meant to be demeaning. And now it's sort of, depending on your viewpoint, changed over time.
Yeah, I like the different representations here, actually, of masculinity and femininity on screen in a way that you wouldn't really see today, and it being kind of normalized. And I think what's interesting, too, is that, you know, we have a lot of action films that rope in love stories and things like that. But it is, to your point, a little bit more about the passion of it than it is like the I'm in love with you of it all. And what's implied here very differently is I'm in love with you, whether I want to be or not. You know, she's going off to jail. She's getting dragged off to jail. And he's like, I love you and I'm going to wait for you and all the things, you know? So I think that's really interesting difference in films of this time when I watch it, notably, is that it feels like the love story itself is a little bit more about the love, you know, a little bit like I am in love with you and less about the passion of it. Cause you don't really see that on screen. You know, you're just not seeing the passionate connection there, so to speak.
Yeah, I think you're right there. Last couple of things I had were just sort of, I did think some stuff aged really well. I enjoyed, there was a really pretty, you were talking very early on about sort of the cinematography. I really like that shot where it's focusing on the two partners in the very beginning and then it pans down and the shadow of the Spade and Archer glass window is like on the ground. I think that's a really pretty shot. Yeah. Same with when it's one of the first times I think you see the I've been poisoned and now the frame, it's going blurry. And it's sort of doing this with the camera. I thought that was kind of a cool shot as well. I don't know enough to know that that was the first time that was done, but I still think for its time, it's a little bit revolutionary.
Very cool.
Yeah. Very cool. Even some of the badass humor lands, like some of it is
so fucking funny.
Some of it's over the top. Like some of the like stoic stuff. It's like, okay, we get it. He doesn't care about anything except for this girl. But I really like when he flies off the handle and he throws the glass of liquor, like that is pretty badass. And then even the humorous times, when he's being, I don't know if it's deposed, but he goes to the steno, he's giving the speech, and he's like, you getting all this? Good, you're good at your job. Like, that is spot.
Well,
like,
it's funny you say that, because that line is repeated word for word almost in Aaron Brockovich. And he basically just says, are you getting all this down, son, or am I going too fast for you? And she says, are you getting all this down, honey, or am I going too fast for you? It's like, it's there a repeat, go. and he's going so fast. Like, I just love the pacing of these stories and these lines. And I love that the guy, again, is kind of unfazed. He's like, oh, man, I got it. Thanks. You know, and it's not the reaction you expect. You expect it to be, you know, inciting some kind of response. And yeah, I agree. There's so many funny moments and lines that land. I like the ones where he's like, they're saying that he's being so harsh or clear or something about what he said. And he's like, what do you want me to do? Learn to stutter? Like, you know, he's just so, and he does it like this, you know, he's just so snarky and on it. And he's not the only one. Effie's like that too. Mm-hmm. Effie is very responsive. She's right there with him. Bridget is not as much, but she has a couple little zingers here and there where she's, and it's where she feels actually like the most honest on a couple of occasions too, where she just like pops it right out. And I don't know if that's an intentional choice as an actress, where when she's lying, she has to think a lot longer about what she's saying versus when she's being authentic, it just comes right out and it's very witty. I like that. To me, it's something I like to think about and notice between the two of them. And I like also, to your point, there's some great shots in this and there's some great lighting in this. There's great use of lighting. And I think the thing to call out for folks is like, this is all on a soundstage, right? This is all pretty much done in a studio sound setup. And they create these shots and these setups from a lighting perspective that work really well for a really dark, shadowy night or dark, creepy office or a bright morning waking you up, you know, like what have you. And I think it lands really well and it's shot really well in some seemingly interesting spaces for sure.
Yeah, it's a very pretty film. I don't think there was a single time there was when he first goes to see it, find his partner and at the bottom of the hill, just the technology of the time, it looks really blurry. I almost thought that was green screened in at first because of how blurry, but literally that's the only shot for the whole film where I was like, oh, this feels a little aged outside of the black and white, obviously. But when you mentioned sound, and I have to laugh. We know that the fights in movies do not, that's not the sounds that punches and kicks and things make. But in this, that slapping sound, especially when he does it on the guy's like dress shirt and jacket, and it's making a physical slap sound.
Yeah.
And then also like the throat punch. It's just such a fake. It's like a popping paper that you would make in middle school. It's like that slappy thump noise. That's what it's making. And that just made me giggle.
Well, and the throat punch is interesting because she gasps at the same time and it creates this very weird sound. That's one that stood out to me too. And I also like the coat move where he's like pulling down the coat on him so he can get the guns out. And you're just like, in what universe does that work? You know, and like the sound effects are crazy. Jeez. And it's just, it's so funny. Like there are very unintentionally funny moments. And then there are just like funny, fun to watch looking at this older film and things like that. I really like one of my favorite lines is when he says to Effie, you're a good man, sister. Yeah. And
I mean, that validates your point earlier of like, he doesn't see her as, you know, a sexual possibility. It's just they're partners. Yeah.
You're just my partner. You're my friend, you know, whatever. And I just thought, like, what a high compliment back then, especially to be for a man to consider you essentially an equal. I mean, yes, he makes her do some bitch work. Don't get me wrong, but on as close to equal as is going to happen.
I don't think you're allowed to call it bitch work, Mackenzie. People might be offended by that.
I mean, I would call it bitch work if somebody made me do it. So, but anyways, you know, whatever.
Regardless of who's doing it, it's bitch work is what we're saying.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. It doesn't matter who's doing it. If I tell you to do it, it's bitch work too. You know what I mean? But she's basically getting all these, you know, not so fun tasks, but she's also a strategic resource for him. And I like that they like bandy ideas off of each other and she's telling him her observations. And anyway, I love their partnership. It's one of my favorite things about this movie, and that she is just she's given this really high compliment and she just rises to the occasion over and over again. So I think she's the funnest character in that way.
She's the short round of this movie. Another series that probably took from this genre a little bit, Indiana Jones, because we've talked about those mythical objects that come into play and that's the driving force behind it. So yeah, and then she's definitely the short round. You called out the silliness of the coat pull move.
Yeah.
And God, these movies, it's like I've seen it made fun of in cinema so often, but you all now to see the real thing of like the bad guy has a gun on me. These are the least efficient henchmen of all time, but I'm just going to push it to the side and do the like exaggerated punch across the screen.
Yeah.
That happens, I think, twice in this. The fact that he gives him his loaded gun back after he had him at gunpoint is like, well, we're good now.
Well, I just love that he's like wants to search the apartment, you know, and he lets him have it back and he gives it to him and he just like laughs at the fact that he's still going to search the apartment. He's like, really? Yeah. After all that? And he just like lets him do it, which is fine. But it's just like, what
did you have improved over time? Is at this point the good guy would take the bullets out of the gun and give him back. And like then the guy would try to pull it. Oh, I took the bullets out. That would be improved upon. Whereas there's multiple times in this where people have guns on him. They do the little fake punch thingy. He gets the best of them. And it's 1941. What are you going to do?
What are you going to do? What are you going to do?
Why did they why did they leave him alive? They poison him, but they are willing to set a boat on fire and kill multiple people, but they're not willing to shoot this detective. They end up that was confusing to me.
Well, I think the implication is that there weren't actually that many people on the boat. That was more about like,
they said everybody got evidence. Off.
Yeah, everybody got off. That was more about destroying evidence. I don't think they want to kill people mostly to not call attention to themselves. And I think for him, it is definitely about calling attention to him. You know, he's a private detective. His partner has just died. They know he's in the middle of this investigation and has been speaking to police. He's made it clear that he's motivated by any number of things, right? He could be willing to turn them in. He could be willing to get the money. He could be, you know, whatever. There are millions of possibilities for him. So I think for them, it's safer to just remove him from the scenario, albeit not permanently, right? Like buy them some time and just get him out of the picture if they can without having to kill him and draw attention to what they're doing, I think is the point there.
Okay. And like some of the reveals do make more sense by the end of like who killed who. So yeah, they're trying to, now that we know they didn't kill his partner, it makes a little more sense that they're just killing folks that are involved with this. But just to go back to one of the things, I don't love the scene where they're like, well, now we're just going to sit in this room together, all of us, overnight. It feels like it's happening in real fucking time because it's like a 15-minute scene. And it just doesn't feel like, because of all the stuff I just said about, we never feel like there's any stakes because none of our primary cast are being, I mean, he points out, you can't kill me, you can't torture me, which takes a lot of the tension out for me watching that scene. And then they do the whole, well, I'm going to ask you about all these people that this guy killed so that we can, and I guess it's to produce sort of Patsy for the rest of them to get them out of trouble. But it just, I don't love the 15-minute scene where we're just explaining everything that's happened to this point in the movie.
See, I think it can be done better as far as how it's presented, but I think it's important. I think it's important in that it's connecting a lot of dots, you know, for people and for the viewer. But yeah, I agree. I think there's better ways to do it. And in fact, not exactly the same way, but what we're going to talk about next week in All About Eve, I think is that that's just one example of one that does it better, of like trying to help you connect some dots that you didn't know were there in a different way that is not so, you know, straight on of, here's exactly what happened and here's why and blah, blah, blah.
If anything, it makes me want to read the book because I think a good mystery story, if that's what we're calling this, you know, it interweaves throughout. Yeah. And I think if it had been told better in the first half to two thirds of this, the ending would ring better. I look at something like Knives Out, and I think that's a movie where, yes, everything that happened, and you get the whole catch up for like a 5 minute scene at the end of here's everything that happened. Yeah. And they show you scenes you didn't see before, ties everything together. But they had done such a great job of setting all those mysteries up. Whereas in this, it's like, okay, there's a bird. We might have it. We don't. This person died. But now let's, in the last 10 minutes, explain everything that happened. It just doesn't connect the dots, even though that's what it's trying to do for me.
I could see that. I think it's, I think you have to kind of take some work on and interpret some folks and their motivation there for it to like mean more. I think what does kind of bring it together to me more at the end is more about like, if you think about this last line that he has, you know, he's turning her in. He's decided like he is a very principled man, right? We are kind of unsure about, he again is very morally ambiguous throughout. You're not really sure what he's in it for or who he's in it for, and his blustering to the cops and then to these bad guys and what have you lends you to think you have no idea what he's going to go for at the end, right? And ultimately he turns her in. He is out for making sure that, you know, the murder of his partner is caught. He is willing to turn in this thing that is the impetus for all of this. And I like his line where he's, you know, he says, you know, this, they ask him what it is. And he says, well, this is the stuff that dreams are made of. And it's kind of this, it's a great line in and of itself, but two, it's a repeat, right? It's from Shakespeare. And I love that callback to, you know, this fantasy being the stuff that dreams are made of, right? It's, this was all a dream. This was all a fantasy, whether this idol was real or not. Like, it has driven all this action, it has driven all this forward, and it's all kind of based on this dream and this fake story. And and it's this very, I think, punchy, sarcastic line that's subtle, and I think a great way to close out this story that's been kind of about those things.
Yeah, we get everything defined about Sam in the last 10 or 15 minutes of, you know, we've talked about where is he emotionally, right? What does he actually care about? Does he have a moral compass? All this stuff. And we find out that he's a better detective than we thought, even though the first half of the movie doesn't do it. It's like, oh, the villain circled the boat that they're going to. Lucky for you, detective. Just little things like that. But I did think it was smart that we see how his plan comes together. He gets them arrested, right? Has the confessions, keeps the $1,000 from the envelope. He says it's for his expenses, but ends up like giving that to the cops too, of saying this was the money they were going to bribe me with. And he should have hung on to it, because with inflation, $1,000 now is $4.6 million. I do think that it ties it together. And like the character of Sam, did they make more? I know that Bogart did a bunch of noir films, but did they reuse the character of Sam Spade again?
No.
Okay, because it feels like a Bond where they could have just run this back again and again, but I guess maybe source material prevented that?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of sequence thrillers is definitely like a late, you know, like a late 50s, early 60s thing. Okay. At this point, you're cranking out film noir that's just like one new character after the next. And definitely most of them are based in murder, but a lot of them are about like theft and things like this. This is one of the first ones that has the, like, that combo of both. And so it kind of creates this template of like, go be free, do an art heist one, do a murder one, what have you. And so you see a lot more
in a lot of them, and I hope, yeah, okay, see, yeah,
Bogart, I was gonna say, so you see a lot more of Bogey being basically a similar character.
They always have alliterative names. Like,
no,
Petey
they
Pistol.
Don't but they're Jimmy also Thompson. They are, I will say too, the reason they're enjoyable is they are different enough, but I just mean, you see the influence of this character. And also I to clarify too, you see more folks that are not Bogey playing this person, right? This type of character. So it becomes, it's very much a trope that is being reused over and over again, kind of during this period, during the film noir period. But there are people, like I said, who do it really well. And there are those that don't do it as well. So to that end, one, I would love to hear your rating. And two, I would love to hear, like, from a film noir standpoint, what are the reasons you think you don't like the genre potentially?
It's all going to tie back, and I'm not trying to oversimplify this and just say, oh, it's James Bond. That's not what I'm trying, but I've never even been a Bond fan. I don't know which books came out first, but I think that the movie character, the movie version, borrows from this genre pretty heavily, just based on what I've seen, very limited scope. But I've just never been a fan of like the tough guy, nothing to lose. There's never any stakes because you know he's going to survive every movie. You have these interesting villains, but they kind of feel, to what we were talking about, they feel like wrestling characters. It feels like, okay, they have to have like a thing about them that makes them a different villain, just to mix it up. You have 2 to 3 women every movie that the main character wants to sleep with. I've never been a fan of that genre specifically. So watching this, I was like, this is just the early stages of movies that I didn't end up being a fan of. So it's very personal. Like, I'm not going to say it's nothing personal. It's absolutely personal because I see how people can enjoy this, and I see for its time, it's revolutionary. So if I were to rate it on an objective scale of how good would this be to someone else who does like that genre, it's probably like a 7.5 and 8. I think it's, you know, people would like this. On a personal level, I'm going to give it like a 5.5. It was watchable, but I don't really love the genre, so I don't want to sit down and watch this again.
Wow, that's so low. That's so much lower than I thought. Oh my God, I'm trying not to cry. I love film noir, as is clear. I will say, again, I don't think this is the best entry. I think this is one of the most well-known entries.
What would you recommend? Like, if I were going to give a second one a chance from this era-ish, which one would you suggest?
I mean, it sounds like a big part of your complaint is more about the, like, blustering guy who doesn't have feelings and, like, you know, these kinds of things that you get kind of roped up in this character rather than the mystery is my takeaway from what you're saying. I think The Lady Vanishes predates this, actually. That's 1938, 37, something like that. That's a Hitchcock. Well, that was on the list that I sent you. So basically look at the list that I sent you.
I didn't read the list.
Oh my God. It's okay, guys. We're not going to fight again. It's fine. No, there are a few on there specifically that do this better. And this is one of the ones, to your point, that I threw in because it is more well known. But like Double Indemnity, I think, does this better. And I think, and that's like a Billy Wilder film. So like Billy Wilder is a very well-known famous director in this genre as well. Lots of things Hitchcock are repetitive in motion, but some of them are excellently well done. Lady Vanishes is one of them. So yeah, and I think it also too, if you're not looking for like just a tough guy, but a little bit more well-rounded character, a little bit later, To Catch a Thief is a really fun film noir with Cary Grant and Grace Kelly. And it's still got mystery and it's got a little bit of that Bond type of like suaveness like you're talking about, but the point of the story is not that he's this, you know, blustering emotionless detective type, right? So it's more about the story, I think. But I think The Lady Vanishes might be one of my absolute favorites as far as film noir, so definitely recommend that.
I've written that down. What about you? What's your rating on this one? I'm sorry that I gave it a 5.5.
Well, don't get me wrong, like I everything you're saying, and I hope that was clear throughout, I hear you because I think it can be done better. But I can't help but look at what a not quite beginning, but what a standout in the genre it was, the way that it impacted so many other films. But also I think on a first watch, it is a fun watch. It is really interesting, albeit a little bit confusing depending on the time. I like the performances. I love Effie as a character, as I've said. So I still have a great time watching this movie. You know, I still think it's a great time. I think it ends with, I love a level last line that makes you think, you know, you always can like win me over at the end if there's something like that. So I think I would give it like a 7.5. I still think it's a good time. I would rate things like The Lady Vanishes, for example, higher, but I do think it's really good. It's still a good time.
Oh, I did one other thing that I really did like about it. And I meant to use this at the beginning when we did our cheers with our drinks, but I love the cheers of here's to plain speaking. I'm stealing that toast.
I do like that.
Okay, let's get drunk and be honest with each other. Yeah.
Yeah, let's just get drunk. And he's such a straight shooter. I do like that about him. You know, I like that he's just so direct and straight shooter. And he's, I mean, you don't quite know what his motivation is, but he's also not like actively lying, if that makes sense. So yeah, I find him interesting. But yeah, well, thanks for hanging in, since apparently this was not your favorite. We are going to wrap things up next week from a classics perspective, at least for the time being, until I can coerce Lamar into watching more of these. But we're gonna round things out with, like I said at the top, one of my faves, which is All About Eve. If you haven't seen it, check it out. I don't know if it's rentable, but
I enjoyed it more than this one. So if you're like, oh, I don't want to, like,
what a rave fucking review, by the way. It was better than this one that I didn't like.
Four that we've done this month, this was my least favorite. And still, it's a 5.5. I'm not saying it's not a bad movie. It's just not my cup of tea.
It's not a straight up not watch. So there's that. Right. I think we can take that away from it.
Just don't do it on Max if you want to use subtitles.
Oh God, truly. Like, it was so bad. Okay. But for those of us who are like arguably hard of hearing when there's a movie on, it's very hard not to use subtitles. So yes, Max, get your shit together. But in the meantime,
follow us on our socials, Instagram. We are kicking FanJan off again next month. So if you're not already following us on Instagram, you have a chance to vote on which movies you want us to do in January. So keep an eye out for that. We're also
one of the few times we'll listen to you, you know, like once a year, we don't give a shit about we'll throw you a bone, you know.
We already know that I don't read Mackenzie's list, so I definitely don't read
fucking
your guys'
for
list.
Real though. You know what I'm gonna do, guys? I'm gonna throw it in on Instagram for y'all. Maybe you guys will read it and watch it, because it took fucking work and I would love somebody to actually read it.
And aside from that, yeah, keep watching, keep listening, YouTube, Spotify. If you're not already following, subscribe. That definitely helps us. And yeah, let us know more of what you want outside of FanJan. What do you guys want to hear?
Absolutely. Love it. All right. But for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.
And drink this surprisingly good drink.
Yeah, good call at Craft World. Tasty.
Yeah. Shout out.